Telecommunications Industry Therapy. Michelle and I are picking up part two of our conversation with James Rudlinger on the pair of ANSI standards, TIA 322 and A1048.
This podcast is provided by the Telecommunications Industry Foundation. This podcast, as well as much more additional content, can be found at tiffonline.org. Please welcome your hosts, Michelle Kang and Scott Stecker.
So let's switch gears here a little bit and talk a little bit about more the practical application of standards from, let's say, a contractor's perspective. So besides just literally buying the standard and having a shelf queen, like, how do I, as the contractor, what's my best practice to purchase this new 1019A and adopt what it says? What would you recommend to me?
Sure. And now it's, you know, definitely with both of these standards are standalone documents. They, while it is certainly beneficial, and I would highly recommend anyone that's, you know, if you're an engineering firm that's providing construction consulting services, while you could do that theoretically, strictly working with the 322A standard, you absolutely should be very well-versed within requirements of the A1048, and vice versa. If you're a contractor that consistently gets involved in construction classification for work that require a qualified engineer to be engaged, while you can work exclusively with the A1048, I would say it's highly recommended to at least be competent within the 322A standard. As far as utilization of these standards, they do provide, you know, prescriptive minimum requirements for documentation purposes, for considerations on this extremely unique infrastructure that we work upon. We've got construction considerations that are unmatched within any other construction trade. We work on a very, very slender and very tall infrastructure. We are consistently designing in the field hoisting systems that are directly attached to that infrastructure. You know, we're essentially going out to, when we're doing any hoisting applications, we're developing a in situ crane, you know, crane at that individual site. Every site, you know, which is really does require some unique considerations. And, you know, contractors that are providing services in this line of work, it's absolutely paramount that you are familiar with these unique standards that apply to the infrastructure.
And are we talking CEO down to tower hand? Like, who's familiar with these standards, or who should be?
Well, with being directly involved with the state, I think everybody should be. These are great reads, great figures. You know, it's excellent information. You know, it really, seriously, the individuals that are, you know, when we look at A1048, the individuals that are serving the role as a qualified person, individuals that are serving the role as a competent rigger, they absolutely need to have training. They need to have access, and they need to spend the time to become educated with requirements that are within these standards. And it's same with engineering. You know, in any engineers that are offering construction support services or construction design equipment, they absolutely need to be well-versed within the minimum requirements we have within these standards.
What about engineers that are producing rigging plans for contractors? Like, how does that work or not work?
Well, that's a great question. Engineers that are serving as a qualified engineer as defined within the 1048 and 322 standards absolutely should not be engaged in actually creating or developing that construction plan. That would be the responsibility of the contractor to develop the construction plan and pass that over to the qualified engineer for specific review of the structures strength and stability in accordance with the 322 standard. Now, if an engineer is serving as a supervising engineer, again, as defined within the 322 and the A1048 standard, they may be also assuming some degree of responsibility for development of that construction plan. In rare cases, it could be full development of the construction plan, but what we traditionally still see is that the contractor best practices would be for the contractor to initially develop the portion of the construction plan and then work directly with a supervising engineer to fill in any areas where special procedures may need to be defined. So the short answer, again, if an engineer is serving as a qualified engineer, then absolutely not. They should not be developing that construction plan for the contractor. If they're serving as a supervising engineer, then they could be providing some additional oversight or development of that construction plan, again, based upon the contract they have for the scope of work they're providing back to the contractor.
So that's an excellent point. I think hits it home perfectly as the balance of what engineers truly need to consider when they're working with these two standards. But, you know, your long career here, what just in the past 10 years, for example, what changes have you seen as it relates to the construction that we do in our industry?
There's a tremendous difference in just the overall size of the workforce. And we, you know, whenever, and it might be that I was a little sheltered, you know, first coming into the industry, but in the late 90s going into the early 2000s, while there certainly was wireless activity, it was primarily new builds. There wasn't a tremendous amount of co-location activity. There wasn't a tremendous amount of modification activity. Most of the construction that was being done was, you know, that I obviously had my eyes open to was broadcast specific within a very small realm of companies. We're talking less than two dozen. Primarily about a dozen. And, you know, the outside of that broadcast within wireless, it was really primarily dealt with new installs, you know, new pole installations, new original equipment installations. And the level of rigging experience and the construction methods that were being utilized at that time were vastly different. If when you're constructing a new monopole for a single carrier, they typically didn't install the pole and then wait 5 years and install equipment. A lot of times they'd like to do them both at the same time. But even if there was a lag, even if you had a build to suit come in and build out a tower and then you had a carrier come in and add equipment, it was an empty tower. It was a clean slate to work on. When I would say over the past 10 years, you know, we haven't seen nearly as much new construction. Still goes on, but the primary boots in the field are working on existing infrastructure, and they're trying to install equipment. They're trying to install modifications on towers that are already supporting other equipment, other generations of modifications. So it really changes the considerations and the actual constraints that they have. There's also, you know, suburban crawl. These sites aren't wide open a lot of times like they were when they were first built out. So just equipment positioning requirements and constraints can be vastly different. And, you know, it's probably the easiest one to point to is truly the co-locations. You just don't have a lot of headspace anymore when you're setting a top block and you're trying to lift modifications or equipment. You're dealing with a lot of obstructions that are on that tower.
And what about specifically, say, education over the last 10 years, right? We have two standards that, you know, maybe 1019 is 10 years old, but 1048 certainly isn't. How about the speed at which those get adopted and implemented into the workforce?
The question is more of how important is it to
not necessarily the importance, but the change in, 20 years ago, you were doing construction and you had a lot of existing knowledge and you had, say, a mentor that was teaching you exactly what to do, right? Now I have standards, and if I am capable and I can read, I can now basically understand how to do my job if I pick up and read these materials, correct?
Absolutely. And it's again the expansion of the workforce. Standards are imperative for our industry to make the work scalable. And we're chasing it. It's the work's there. The workforce is there. There's the boots on the ground we have to maintain compliance. We have to maintain minimum requirements to allow for this industry to allow for this work to be done safely in a scalable fashion. As you said, it's when you've only got a handful of companies doing construction, and it's a really finite amount of opportunities out in the field, there's a different level of tribal knowledge that can facilitate. You can't work off of tribal knowledge today. We've got too many individuals in the field. We've got too big of an infrastructure to support, to rely on the quote unquote best practices. We need minimum requirements.
Absolutely. Shell, any other questions for James?
No, I think we're good, Scott. Just want to say, James, thank you for all the time and effort that you've put into these standards over the years. It's been very, very significant and recognized by many and helped many people. And also thank you for spending the time with us today to talk about the critical updates to these standards and also your recommendations on how to best utilize them. I think our audience will definitely walk away understanding the level of importance of these standards and how to gain the necessary knowledge to go perform construction based on these standards.
Michelle, Scott, thank you very much. Again, both the newly revised 322A and the A1048 2023 revisions are available as of today. Both are readily available, and both do become fully effective as January 1 of 2024. Again, thank you very much.
Thanks, James.
Thank you for listening to Industry Therapy, presented by the Telecommunications Industry Foundation. The information expressed herein are the opinions of the individuals. They are not meant to supersede regulations, standards, or AHJ requirements that govern the referenced subject matter. To view additional TIF podcasts and other educational content, or to submit a potential topic for a future podcast, please visit our website, tifonline.org.